Today is Thursday, May 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, all 50 U.S. states are opening back up, but a new poll finds a majority of Americans may not be ready.
83% are at least somewhat concerned easing restrictions in their area will lead to more infections.
Concerning COVID news from the World Health Organization.
The most in a single day since the outbreak began.
Also ahead, South Americans can't go out to enjoy traditional music, so it is coming to them. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is doubling down on his decision to take a controversial drug despite scant evidence that the anti-malaria drug is effective at stopping infection or curing patients with the coronavirus. And on another front, the president is pushing forward with a threat to permanently withdraw funding for the World Health Organization. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara reports.
President Donald Trump, who reportedly has tested negative for the coronavirus, defended his decision to take hydroxychloroquine. He said he has been taking it for the past 2 weeks and dismissed an unnamed survey about the drug.
If you look at the one survey, the only bad survey, they were giving it to people that were in very bad shape. They were very old, almost dead. It was a Trump enemy statement.
There's little known about the drug's effectiveness in battling the coronavirus, but it could have serious side effects, including heart problems. David Sullivan is a professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
I would not recommend people just taking it to try to prevent them getting the virus at the present time, because the risks do outweigh the benefits if you're just trying to take it for prevention, unless you're in a randomized clinical trial where you can find the answer.
In the middle of the drug dust-up, President Trump is also pushing ahead with his threat to permanently cut off funding for the World Health Organization, accusing the WHO of allowing China to cover up its part in the coronavirus outbreak.
Basically, they have to clean up their act. They have to do a better job. They have to be much more fair to other countries, including the United States.
As U.S. criticism mounted, WHO member states agreed to an independent probe into the U.N.'s agency's coronavirus response. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
WHO remains fully committed to transparency, accountability, and continuous improvement.
Trump declined to speak at the assembly where Xi Jinping addressed WHO members. The Chinese president said he supported an investigation, but said it should wait until the pandemic is contained. He also announced China will provide $2 billion to help with the COVID-19 response in developing countries. Robert Daly is the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
China is now working with the rest of the WHO as a member, and it can use that inside the tent status and its professed willingness, I think you can question its sincerity, to be part of the investigation. I think we can expect to see China use that insider status to slow walk and limit the investigation going forward, whereas the United States increasingly is placing itself outside of that process.
The U.S. supported the WHO resolution, but objected the call for universal, timely, and equitable access to vaccines, saying the language used would send the wrong message to innovators concerned about intellectual property. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Well, meanwhile, the World Health Organization is expressing concern over the number of novel coronavirus cases being reported as many nations, including the United States, begin to reopen. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus speaking at a news conference on Wednesday.
In the last 24 hours, there have been 106,000 cases reported to WHO, the most in a single day since the outbreak began.
As countries around the world loosen their coronavirus restrictions, it is back to business, but it won't likely be business as usual. As every state in the United States begins to reopen, a new poll finds widespread concern to rolling back restrictions, with many fearing another round of infections. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
All 50 states are now at least partially reopened, and a poll finds Americans have high expectations for what's needed to resume everyday life. The AP NORC Center for Public Affairs Research poll finds 83% of Americans are at least somewhat concerned that lifting restrictions will lead to more infections, and they're putting the burden on fellow citizens. 8 in 10 say it's essential others return to self-quarantine if exposed to the virus. Roughly two-thirds say widespread testing of their areas is essential. Roughly the same number want people to keep socially distancing and wearing masks, though there's a big partisan divide over that. As restrictions are lifted, no more than a third in the poll say they'll definitely resume normal activities if allowed, like going to the movies or the gym. But majorities say they would at least probably visit friends and family and get haircuts. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Field hospitals, ambulances, ventilators, masks, and even personnel are among the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of assistance the U.S. has recently diverted to African nations in their fight against the coronavirus pandemic. VOA's Anita Powell spoke exclusively with Assistant Secretary of State Clark Cooper of the Bureau of Political Military Affairs about how U.S. peacekeeping operations are finding creative ways to empower African nations to fight the virus. She reports from Johannesburg.
As the African continent girds itself for what experts say is an inevitable tide of coronavirus cases, the U.S. government is trying to find creative ways to quickly render assistance. Those include repurposing existing peacekeeping assets, like field hospitals and medical equipment, to fight the virus. Assistant Secretary of State Clark Cooper of the Bureau of Political Military Affairs.
There's medical equipment that has been applied as well as training delivered to partners like Ghana, Rwanda, Senegal, and Uganda for participation in international peacekeeping. And so what we had assessed is that, of course, when times are tough, and they are right now, particularly with the COVID pandemic, we wanted to bolster these capacities, but also remind partners like Ghana, Rwanda, Senegal, and Uganda, that a true friend lends a helping hand in times of crisis. And we are proud to be the number one provider on humanitarian assistance to countries worldwide.
This is, he notes, not the first time the U.S. has diverted peacekeeping supplies to fight a viral war. In 2014, the U.S. did the same in response to West Africa's Ebola epidemic.
If one looks back at the 2014 Ebola crisis, that is where the Department of State and the Department of Defense sought to apply flexibilities on field hospitals, ambulances and equipment, as well as training packages in places that were impacted. And that it actually did provide us a template for now, for 2020. So 6 years later, we're able to look back at how we reapplied resources that were either already fielded or were already identified to be fielded in Western Africa and Central Africa at the time. So it certainly did provide us, again, the kind of a template for what we are doing today.
Additionally, the U.S. has given approximately $270 million worth of bilateral assistance to fight the virus, including more than $30 million to Nigeria, more than $26 million to the Democratic Republic of Congo, more than $23 million to Ethiopia, and nearly $22 million to South Sudan. And in South Africa, the continent's viral hotspot, the U.S. government recently donated nearly 730,000 protective masks for health workers, as well as about 1,000 ventilators. But what, we asked Clark, do these efforts have to do with keeping the peace on a continent battered by insecurity? More than you'd think, he said.
It is not in the normal space of security cooperation work. However, it is part of a broader long-term investment in each other. And so we certainly want to make sure that our partners have the capacities not only for their sovereignty and their self-defense, but they maintain their capacities as far as being a partner with us on security. So now what we're doing here does provide significant long-term dividends for us collectively. I mean, when we look at the virus, like terrorism, for example, it does not know boundaries. It does not respect geopolitical borders. And so the virus affects everyone and it does not spare anyone. So reapplying what we can does allow for us to, again, not only maintain capacities, but also help each other in a time of extremis.
And these, he said, are nothing if not extreme times in Africa and around the globe. Anita Paul, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Meanwhile, Southern African leaders met on Wednesday to discuss the growing Islamist insurgency in northern Mozambique. The heads of state agreed the violent insurgency poses a threat to the region, but did not announce plans for action. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
At the day-long meeting in Harare, leaders of Zambia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique said they had discussed the COVID-19 pandemic and the security situation in Southern Africa, including Lesotho, where Prime Minister Thomas Thabane resigned this week after months of pressure over his alleged role in the murder of his former wife. But much of the talk centered on Mozambique, where an Islamist insurgency has raged in the Cabo Delgado province since 2017. Media reports say the situation has deteriorated in the past month and these insurgents have killed nearly 1,000 people and displaced tens of thousands more. Mozambique President Filipe Nyusi told reporters that he was hopeful that the continent would rally behind his administration in driving out the jihadists.
We as Mozambique, we reported about the situation of Mozambique, concretely about the armed attacks or violence attacks from outsiders and using our young peoples in our region. We received the solidarity and together we discussed what to do. We believe that we together are going to work hard to make sure that our region is peaceful. Armed attacks like that looks like terrorists. The terrorism you can't fight alone. This is the experience what we have. We needed to share the forces.
The meeting took place under the banner of the Southern African Development Community SADC Security Committee. The meeting's final communique said the region would support the former Portuguese colony, but did not specify what form of support would take. Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa, the current chair of the security bloc, refused to confirm if his country or the region would deploy armed forces to Mozambique. He said in his opening remarks that the security situation was dire. At the end of the meeting, he said,
"An attack on any member state of SADC is an attack on the rest of members of SADC."
Alexander Lucero, a former international relations and security studies lecturer at Harare Polytechnic College, says he's sure that SADC will send troops to Mozambique.
So proliferation of terrorism in Mozambique is actually a cause for concern. And one way or the other, the regional bloc has to intervene because SADC is more of a security architecture than it is a development community, which is in its name.
Unlike the West African bloc ECOWAS, SADC does not have a standing army. But individual countries have in the past deployed their armies to quell security threats in other members' countries. Zimbabwe sent troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1998. South Africa sent troops to Lesotho the same year. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The rate of new coronavirus cases has slowed in New York City, which was once the epicenter of the outbreak in the United States. But healthcare professionals are still working around the clock to save thousands of people infected with the virus. COVID-19 attacks the lungs, which is why pulmonary specialists of all types are especially needed. For the next part of our ongoing series of interviews with frontline health workers, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke by Zoom with Sydney Van Ness, a registered respiratory therapist who left her family in New Jersey over a month ago to serve in a Brooklyn, New York hospital. Brooklyn has seen a disproportionate number of cases in the state.
I have been in that unit now for a little bit over a month, helping stabilize the unit, helping manage the flow of the unit, and helping manage the nurses, just making sure everybody's wearing proper PPE and being a support system for the staff and patients themselves.
So you were the patients too?
I'm not their primary nurse, but I do have to go into the room many times when they have questions or concerns. The truth is, the patients that are here are very scared. You're alone. They don't know what's going on. They see these astronaut-looking people going into their rooms day in and day out, and just to have them be able to connect helps them a lot.
Has it been hard for you personally to adjust to working constantly on a COVID ward?
At the beginning, I was terrified. But the fact that Jackson has given us what we need in order to feel safe has helped a lot. We always have what we need to work together and protect everybody, both the patient and the nurses. If healthcare workers do not protect themselves, we can be carriers and we can be the ones spreading this even more than what is being spread already.
Do you have enough nursing staff?
I've been very blessed to have nurses who want to come back and work in these units because of how safe they feel. They'd rather work in a COVID unit knowing what to expect than work in a regular floor where they don't know who has COVID.
You can have great protection, but there is still so much that is unknown about COVID-19.
It's exactly what you just said. You do not know who really has COVID or not until they are swabbed and come back positive.
How have you managed to cope with all this uncertainty and trauma?
At the beginning, it was very hard for me. In the first few weeks from being in a COVID unit, I found myself just wanting to lay in bed all day. I was seeing what nurses were going through. I was seeing what patients were going through. I was seeing the hard truth of what this virus does. Nursing takes a toll on you physically, mentally, on a regular day. And now you throw in a virus that we don't know about. It's just an added stress to you. So I had to find a way to cope with it. I had to find a way to know that giving all that I can is making a difference. I would love to get back to my normal life, but until then, I am here. I'm here to fight this war, and I am proud to be part of a healthcare system that truly shows that they care about their nurses and always make sure that they feel safe in this crazy world that we're living right now.
Do you think that the public is actually grateful for everything you guys are doing?
The support that we are receiving from the community is amazing. On a daily basis, I receive multiple messages through Facebook or Instagram from people who don't even know me, just reaching out and saying, hey, thank you for helping. You know, like when a lot of us are afraid and at home, you guys are out there and you're doing everything you can for these patients.
What's your personal situation?
I have two boys. They are currently with my parents who have been taking care of them for the past month and a half. It's been very hard for them, especially for the little one. He doesn't understand why he can't come around mom or why I can't hug him or why I can't give him a kiss. So I'm very lonely right now.
What is the outlook, in your opinion, going forward?
We're projecting hopefully by June to see a drop in numbers. But that all depends on the public and how they react to the opening of certain areas in the city.
Here in New York, and I think it's also true in Miami, people are going out without masks on. That must feel almost like a personal affront.
It really is. When I'm on my way to work, I'm just astonished. I see what I'm going through and what my nurses are going through. And when I come out to the public, it just hurts. The fact that people are not taking this as serious as they should be. Due to that, we're going to see an increase in numbers. It's mandatory to wear a mask. But in my own building where I live in, people are not wearing masks. They just get into the elevators with their fellow neighbors, and I don't know what planet they're living in. The least we can do is protect one another.
That's Sydney Venice, a registered respiratory therapist working in Brooklyn, New York, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Britain's Cambridge University became one of the first in the world on Wednesday to announce that all of its lectures will be delivered online over the next academic year because of the coronavirus outbreak. The university shut its campuses to students in March after the British government introduced a strict lockdown and says teaching will be delivered virtually until the summer of 2021. A powerful cyclone barreled into eastern India on Wednesday, bringing heavy rain, wind, and waves as millions of people were evacuated from there and neighboring Bangladesh in an operation complicated by the pandemic. Cyclone Amphan began moving inland after brewing for days in the Bay of Bengal to become one of the strongest storms to hit the region in about a decade. And two astronauts will help end a 9-year launch drought for the U.S. space agency NASA next week as they head to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida ahead of their upcoming historic SpaceX flight. It will be the first time a private company rather than a national government sends astronauts into orbit. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. The man accused of being the mastermind and biggest funder of the 1994 Rwandan genocide made a second court appearance on Wednesday. Felician Kabuga appeared before Paris judges who will be deciding whether he should be handed over to a UN tribunal based in Tanzania. The 84-year-old is accused of bankrolling ethnic militias that massacred some 800,000 people. He'd been on the run for 26 years before being found and arrested last Saturday. Joining us now for details on Kabuga's first public court appearance Wednesday is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, I understand you also had a chance to speak with one of the suspect's defense attorneys. Tell us all about that and, of course, the appearance in court.
Mr. Kabuga was brought into court in a wheelchair. He appeared weak, but still he was talking in court. He was asked to confirm his identity. He gave his name, date of birth, and his parents' names. He addressed the court in Kirwanda. It was translated into French. His physical appearance, he looked like a man in his mid-80s of failing health. He was closely shaven, wearing a blue sweater and jeans, and also wore a face mask.
What was the outcome of all of it? And I understand that you did get a chance to speak to his attorney.
His attorneys asked in the first instance for this particular court hearing to be delayed a week. This hearing was really just before three judges who are there to decide whether or not to transfer Kabuga to the UN tribunal. Now, his defense lawyers argued that given that he was only arrested last Saturday, this is going far too quickly. They say that their client hasn't been given enough time to prepare his case. The defense lawyers accused the judicial system in France of trying to just get rid of him, saying it was far too quick and that they really needed time. Now, the court agreed to that, said yes, he would have another week. He will appear back in court in a week's time. The defense lawyer told the court that Mr. Kabuga, and I'm quoting here, he said, Mr. Kabuga is an old man, he's tired and sick. So they also said that they will apply for bail and they will challenge any attempt to extradite him. Earlier in the day, before the hearing, I spoke to one of Kabuga's defense lawyers. He told me that his client was being looked after in prison. He did have access to medical staff. A doctor had seen him, that he was, for the time being, quite happy with how he was being treated in prison. After the hearing, Kabuga was returned to his prison cell.
And so what has been the reaction from the UN tribunal?
Well, the UN tribunal's prosecutor had originally said that Mr. Kabuga's transfer to UN custody would be temporary, and then he would be sent to Tanzania, to Arusha, where the tribunal for Rwanda is based. In the last few hours, that has been changed. He has amended that, and the tribunal is now asking for Kabuga to be transferred to The Hague. The problem is, of course, with coronavirus travel restrictions, they're not sure if they'll be able to get Mr. Kabuga to Tanzania. So that was really one more obstacle which needed to be gotten over in this hearing, given that the defense lawyers were very firm that they didn't want their client to be sent to Tanzania. So for the moment, it's just a matter of waiting. We wait now until May 27th for the next trial date. Then they will hear more proceedings, and they will then have 2 weeks. The judges will have 2 weeks to give their decision on whether Mr. Kabuga will be sent to The Hague. Mr. Kabuga, of course, at that time, will decide whether or not he can appeal that.
Paris-based journalist Catherine Field, thanks so much. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, millions of people around the world say they are having intense, realistic, COVID-related dreams. Forums and websites are dedicated to people sharing those scary dreams, which have prompted scientists and psychologists to look at this development closer. Maxim Moskalko reports.
On lost sleep. But since mid-March, the number of Google searches starting with weird quarantine dreams has surpassed 200 million. Psychologists say more and more of their patients started complaining about weird, anxiety-filled, and stressful dreams after the pandemic set in.
Vivid dreams, for example, and changes in sleep patterns can be associated with various types of stressors or even with post-traumatic stress disorder. So I think that we may see that as a factor. This is a collective trauma, which a collective trauma means that it's an event, a negative event that is very widely experienced in the population that people have direct exposure to, as well as they can be exposed to it via stories that others tell them or through the media.
Another expert, Harvard Medical School professor Deidre Barrett, has been compiling the pandemic dreams descriptions since mid-March. Before the pandemic, she has studied similar occurrences linked to the 9/11 terrorist attacks and the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait.
They're clusters of content themes, like some people dream about getting the virus, they're noticing they can't breathe, they're spiking a fever, and they're afraid they're getting the virus in the dream. Another large group have metaphors for the virus, and the biggest subcluster of those are bug dreams. I've seen just dozens and dozens of different kinds of bugs attacking dreamers. And I think that's partly because in English, the slang word for virus is bug.
Even though the coronavirus is not a predator, but an unseen enemy, the level of threat is still quite high, says psychological professor Roxanne Pritchard.
Threat rehearsal, that during our dream life, we're able to practice disaster scenarios that we don't get to do every day. So dreaming gives us a chance to kind of run those sequences or those programs so we know how to escape from predators, we know what to do when there's a disaster, and we can kind of keep those sequences fresh. So that's one sort of evolutionary hypothesis to the purpose of stress dreams, nightmare dreams, fighting dreams.
Sleep experts encourage people to prioritize good, healthy sleep in this difficult time because lack of sleep can lead to a weakened immune system.
We sleep best when we have a clear, distinguishing difference between day and night. So if our daytimes look very different from our night, that helps us sleep.
Doctors also advise against using smartphones right before bed because the blue light they emit can lead to insomnia. It's healthier to read a good book, preferably with a happy ending. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, in many countries in South America, music is a major part of family life, celebrations, and birthdays. And while the coronavirus lockdowns have made the usually lively streets eerily quiet, mariachi musicians of typically Mexican genre are now in Colombia's capital of Bogota, playing on street corners with their guitars, trumpets, violins, speakers, and microphones, playing for excited residents dancing with glee on their balconies above. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Take care and be well.